from the New York Liberty, Kia Nurse. Kia, thanks a lot for doing this. How are you today?
I'm good, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, of course. How have you been during the last several months where the world has turned into quite the bizarre, politicized, virus-ridden, confusing world that it is right now for many people?
Yeah, it's been really interesting. Fortunately for me, I've been able to get home and be around my family and spend some extra time with them, which I typically don't get in my regular life. So that was the plus side to it. But it's been difficult to obviously get workouts and be ready to go for season. I've got a great support team with my trainer and making sure that I'm still in the gym. So that's been good.
How long did it take for you to get bored with the people that you were just saying you were excited to see for an extended period of time? I was about a week in and I'm like, okay, I don't need to see these people anymore.
Yeah, typically I'm home for like 3 days at a time, maybe a week. So after 3 days, we're usually like, I'm just supposed to be going somewhere. So that was kind of our move.
It's a little strange when you get your routine. When you get, look, and especially for athletes, right? It's one thing for us. When you have a job and you get up in the morning at 7 o'clock, or you get up at 5, depending on your job, or you work nights, whatever it is, our bodies get into a routine. For athletes, everything is extremely cadenced. You know what time you have to get up. You know what time you have to be at practice. For the most part, you are given, you know, you're given an itinerary, right? It's part of being a professional athlete. And especially when you're a high performance athlete like yourself, early on in life, you adhere to these schedules, right? And these rituals that are part of your existence. This must have been very unsettling for you to not have that in your life. And I'd like to get your perspective on how you dealt with that, because it's something that we've all had to deal with. And, you know, there's a joke going around that people haven't put on anything but track pants for the last 3 months. I know that applies to me. It's certainly not a joke, but how have you dealt with the disruption of your routine as a professional athlete?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty similar to what other people are going to. Like you said, you know, I think it's funny when people always say that they're putting on track pants for the last 3 months. I'm like, that's how I go to work every day. That's my attire to go to work. So I think for me, really, it's been trying to figure out, you know, how to be in control and how to control the things that I can control at this time. So like you said, I'm pretty used to when I need to be somewhere, that's where I am. That's what my focus is. And then the rest of the day I can do, you know, what it is that I need to do for myself. And I found in COVID that I would wake up, I would train, and I'd be done by 10 o'clock and like have the entire day to figure out what to do. So I think that was really the tough part about it. And it was really an understanding of, I'm so used to on the go and moving and being in different places in different countries, different cities to train or play games. So it was really understanding my body wasn't going to lose everything that I put in, all the work that I put in the last, you know, 3-4 months leading up to the pause that COVID had put us in. But how do I maintain what I had gained, and how do I try and add to it? It essentially turned into an off season. You know, for me personally, I was coming back from Australia before all the travel bans happened, and I was going into my off season, which is typically a month long. So this turned into actually like a 3-month off season, and then I can eat the way I want to eat. I can train the way I want to train. I get more sleep. And I think that's why we see a lot of athletes coming back now, and they have different bodies, and people are like, oh, that's a skinny version of this athlete. And we have so much more time. We kind of have more time to really feel what our bodies need. And for a lot of us, there's probably a lot of nicks and knacks that are going on in there and injuries that we don't really know about that probably had the opportunity to heal a little bit. So the hardest part was really just finding the positives about what is happening and that there's a pause in life.
I like when you said that's the skinny version, because I just thought to myself, people are going to be, hey, there's Joey, and that's the fatter version or the even fatter version. So I have to ask you about what's happened in the U.S. and Canada to a degree, and all over the world in the last 3 or 4 weeks after the killing, the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis on May the 25th. And again, the way time passes, it's only been a month, but it seems like years already because of the amount of coverage and the reaction and the way people have protested. And look, we know that there are peaceful protesters, people that are there for the cause. And then there are the hooligans who jump into the mix because they see an opportunity for hooliganism. And that to me does not detract from what the bottom line on all of this is. And discrimination is discrimination. Racism is racism. I asked this on my show a couple of weeks ago to Anson Carter, who's been a longtime friend who I've never looked at as black. Right? I asked Mark Fraser, who played for the Leafs, the same question. Longtime friend, never thought of him as black. What is it like to be black?
You know what? I think it's interesting from my perspective because I live in both countries. You know, I've been in the States for 6 years now, and it's very, you know, blatant in your face. You know, racism exists. It exists in Canada as well. I think sometimes it's microaggressions or people think because we're super polite that it's okay. And that's not necessarily the truth. I obviously am friends with a lot of black people. I date an African-American man. You know, he's a tall, athletic build, so I worry about him when, you know, he's out late at night or when he's driving and I know he gets pulled over. That kind of stuff is frightening. But I think essentially the conversation that's being had right now, like everyone is saying, this isn't a moment. This is a movement. This is something that's going to go on, hopefully for years and decades until this really, really gets fixed and so that the next generation have the opportunity to not have to experience racism, to have equal opportunities, to have an equal starting place where the systemic racism is not affecting them on any level. And I think that's going to take a lot of time. It's going to take a lot of fight. And I think it's going to continue to go on for extended periods of time. And it's a conversation that needs to be had, a conversation that needs to incite and inspire change within the world, because I think there's so many different things that occur that people are just so blind to and they haven't seen it. And it's been because that we've been home and the world has been put on pause and our jobs are put on pause and everybody's just sitting around. They have the opportunity to really see it, to really have these difficult conversations that are going to be uncomfortable at times, but it's really getting that understanding, really educating, learning, and the system is functioning fully how it was intended to function. It's not broken. So it's essentially dismantling that system so that the next generation, who is loud and they are engaged and they know what's going on, and that's really great to see, so that they can have a better life.
Yeah, and I think that people say, well, this is unprecedented and it's never happened before. And I totally disagree, right? This happened before throughout history where we've had moments, flashpoints in history. In the late 60s, there were marches for civil rights, the Black Panthers movement. This is not unprecedented. What happened with George Floyd was we've had enough moment. And because of COVID and the fact that everyone wasn't going about their daily lives and their routines had been disrupted, the opportunity presented itself for it to galvanize everyone, right? And of course, they're still racist. They're not galvanized. They are who they are. But it galvanized the people that realized, first, it galvanized the black community, and then it galvanized the white people who say, hey, you know what? I'm not a racist, so if I don't speak up, it's as bad as being a racist because I'm not doing anything to stop racism. And I think that is the most important point in this. And you bring up something that, again, Anson Carter brought up. When you worry about your boyfriend late at night coming home, getting pulled over by a police officer in his car, you look at what happened. I don't know if you saw what happened. I think it was yesterday or the day before, but Chipotle, the chairman of Chipotle, apologized to the player from the NFL, Darius Leonard, because he was discriminated against at a Chipotle location it was yesterday. Everything seems to move so fast, but he took to Instagram on Thursday stating that he and four other people were eating at Chipotle when the manager came up and said that a white man claimed that the group had verbally abused him. And he said towards the end of the meal, the manager comes up not knowing why the manager walking up. He come up with a terrible attitude asking us, do we have a problem? We all lost trying to figure out what really going on. And he said a white guy said that we was verbally abusing him, talking trash to him. It was basically a lie. So even little incidents like this, which are not little, because in the world we live in now, you can post anything, you can get the word out there and people can react. But I have the reason I bring this up is in your life and the circles that you travel in and the life that you live, I know you're concerned about your boyfriend. Have you experienced racism yourself firsthand, and what was it like?
I have. You know, I think what's interesting is it's been a point that's been brought up before, but, you know, racism doesn't really care who you are. You know, athletes have experienced it. It doesn't matter who they are. But a lot of times, just because we are on TV or certain people in certain groups know who we are or what we do, we're not immune to racism. Some people just strictly don't care or strictly don't know. It's based on what we look like. And for me, there's been a couple of different instances. One was in a restaurant that was, you know, typically an expensive restaurant. Two of my friends and I went to go eat. We were on the road. There was me and there was another African-American lady, and then there was my other friend who was white. And for some reason, the way we came into the restaurant, we were put in the back of the restaurant where there was no windows. You couldn't see anything. There was four or five families that came in after us who were white, who were put up in the front where there was a million tables. So we walked past a ton of empty tables, and we were just put right in the last table in the back corner. And, you know, we looked at each other like, this is weird. Like, why are we back here? You know, maybe is it the way that we're dressed because it's a fancy restaurant and, you know, we weren't in our dresses or our suits. And then afterwards, one of my friends obviously went up to the manager and just asked, like, can we move to the front with everybody else? This doesn't make sense. And they didn't seem to think that it was a problem, that they were discriminating in any way, that was just the only available table, which made zero sense considering we walked past a million tables. And, you know, I think that was something that, for me, I understood what was happening. But for my white friend who was with me, she was really uncomfortable in the situation and just didn't really, you know, see it for what it was. I think that was something that was kind of hard to decipher because you don't know how much money I make or what I look like or if I'm able to afford to eat in this restaurant or why I can't or I'm not dressed a certain way. So that was kind of one of the toughest ones to deal with.
Our guest is Kia Nurse. It's 9:39. Joey Vendetta here on this Friday, June the 26th. And before we wrap up, I have to ask you, Kia, with Thursday being the deadline for WNBA players to opt out of the 2020 season amongst a series of concerns for safety and, of course, you know, the bubble situation, tell us what you know about the WNBA and the return and what it's going to look like. How much information do you have? What's the timeline looking like? I hear the date that some players and teams feel like they're rushed to be in Florida, but by July the 6th, the targeted arrival date. But what do you know as far as the return of the WNBA and how far along it is?
Yeah, there's been a lot of conversations that have gone over the last couple of weeks, and it's been conversations that our union has had with the league and then obviously relayed messages to us and all players' conversations. And I think it's been a pretty quick, fast-paced track kind of thing. And I believe, obviously, I've moved back to New York now to finish physical testing and medical testing and then get some workouts in with the coaches and then move to Florida next week. So everything's pretty quick. From what I understand, everything is a go, and that's what we'll be doing. We've received as much information as possible in terms of all the questions we have, and in case of if someone does get sick while we're there, you know, what does the quarantine look like once we get there and we get tested immediately, living and housing situations, how contained is the bubble in terms of the essential workers who are doing their due diligence and absolutely helping us out in a million ways possible, but what does it look like for them? Do they get to go home and then come back? Are they tested as well? So there's a lot of, obviously, health concerns, and our league also includes a lot of mothers. So for those of them who are bringing their children and bringing a caretaker, how does it work? Can we have people at games? And we have a plus one. So it's been really interesting just getting all the questions answered. I think right now, looking at all the professional leagues that are going on, it seems like the WNBA is the one league that's like, yeah, we're going. It's July 6th. So I think it's pretty quick to get moving. I received a call, I think, about 2 weeks ago about this potentially getting started. And then probably once it confirmed last week, I was out here in New York moving. So it's been really fast. It's exciting to obviously get a season hopefully happening and be able to see everyone. And I think it'll be unique in the sense that we have all 144 players in one place and the ability to use our voices and help to inspire change and use the platforms that we have all over the world. You know, I think that'll be really interesting, but it seems like everything is going.
So I'm going to ask you this last question. I want to ask you about the draft pick too. I got to ask you this. I'll ask you two more questions. One will be about the Raptors at the end, but Sabrina Ionescu will be joining the team as the first overall pick from Oregon. Didn't really get to graduate up, didn't get to play her, you know, her last game the way it would have shaken out. You guys definitely have some room to grow based on last season's results. What do you think she brings to the table?
Well, obviously, I think what Sabrina has done in her college career speaks for itself, right? She cemented herself as a superstar, and I think obviously there's going to be a bit of a jump from college to the WNBA just in terms of speed and size and how the game is played. But I think she'll have the ability to continue to bring her playmaking skills. You know, she's a triple-double queen for a reason. So I think that her ability to find people, her assists will be important for us, and then obviously her ability to score from the point guard position. I think that'll help make us tough to guard. Looks like, based on our draft picks this year and our roster, that we're going to play a little bit of small ball and try out and see what that looks like in our league. That's going to be really fun and really exciting to see. So I'm excited to have her as a point guard, and I think she'll grow pretty quickly. She's competitive, so I think that'll help with the rookie transition that you usually get coming in. But I think it'll be great.
All right, last question, and we're taking people's texts, or they can call us at 416-870-0590 in the next segment, 1-888-666-0590, *590 on your cell phone, or you can text us at 590-590. Who is the greatest Raptor of all time, and does Vince Carter deserve a statue or his jersey retired? Carter announced his retirement yesterday because his team's not coming back. Atlanta's not going to make the playoffs. Your opinion, who's the greatest Raptor of all time? I'm saying it's Kyle Lowry because of what he's done for the city. He's stuck around the whole time. He loves Toronto. And I'm not saying that anybody else doesn't love Toronto, but I measure the greatest player of all time, not just on the court. Who's your greatest Raptor of all time? And does Vince Carter deserve to be the first Raptor with his number retired?
You know, I will agree with you on your pick there. I think the legacy, both on and off the court, but especially off the court, is going to be huge in terms of what he's leaving behind. But I'm also going to go with Vince Carter because that's my guy. Like, growing up, when we were watching the Raptors play, like, that was, you know, who we saw. And that was who always got us excited about putting on a Raptors jersey or watching it on TV. So I think absolutely Vince Carter should have his jersey retired. I think what he did for the game of basketball, and as a kid who came up through the entire grassroots system of basketball in Canada, just understanding how he put that on the map. You know, I think when he left, obviously there were some hurt people. I've watched documentaries on it and seen it all. I think there's, you know, both sides to it. I understand sides of it as an athlete and being in that position. But I think what he did to help grow the game, why there's so many Canadians in the NBA today, is because those are all kids that are around my age, a little bit older than me, who we grew up watching Vince Carter and thought that was cool. And what he did was awesome. And I think that's why now we got like 20-plus Canadians in the NBA. So I think he absolutely deserves to have his jersey retired.
And here I was thinking you were going to say it was Bargnani. My bad. Thanks a lot for doing this, Kia. I appreciate
it. No problem.